The Shared Desk, episode 24. Just a quick introduction because I'm playing solo on this little mission, but you're going to hear the lovely voice of Pip Ballantyne a little later on. It is The Shared Desk. I am your host, T. Morris.
I'm sorry, are you addressing me? Because your authority is not recognized in Fort Kickass.
And what we're doing today is a very special Shared Desk, but we're still going to call it episode 24 because we got some catching up to do. And part of that catching up is getting some of the special footage that I record out shortly after I record it. I've done a lot of recording, but I just haven't been getting this stuff out there. So what I'm going to do today is release a special Shared Desk that was recorded last week with two special guests, Nick and Stasia Kelly. Now, these two are some local authors here in Prince William County, and we were giving a presentation on couples who collaborate at Right by the Rails. You can find out more about them by going to Facebook and searching Right by the Rails. And I believe you can also find them on rightbytherails.org. Check the show notes for that. But, you know, speaking of the show notes, last week we mentioned that we were going to be giving a presentation. That's Philippa and myself. We were going to be giving a presentation at the York County Public Library on the 23rd, which is today. All right, got news for you. It's actually next week. June. Ah, brother.
Have I got your attention now?
Let's try July. July 30th, we will be at the York County Public Library for a presentation on steampunk. That's me and Pip. And we're very excited about this. We will probably record it and put it up for a later podcast. I will be putting it up. But I also have a teaser, a quick teaser to just throw in there. We have a special guest coming for the next Shared Desk. That's going to be episode 25, the big 2-5. It's taken us this long to get to 25. And that will be a special guest that has done collaborations with us and scores of many other people. And I cannot wait to get him on here. But let's talk about couples who collaborate. Let's talk about the process. Let's talk with Nick and Stasia Kelly, Pip Ballantyne, and myself at Right by the Rails here in lovely Prince William County, Virginia.
Rangers, this is Marshal Stack of Pentecost. Prepare for neural handshake.
Initiating neural handshake in 15 seconds.
So, as I was saying earlier, thinking when we were sitting down and talking about this, we said, you know, if there's more people in the audience than there was on the panel, then we were going to invoke the rule that we do at the science fiction conventions, but as we go to the bar, and we take the panel.
Unfortunately, now we're not going to do that.
No, that's too many. Can't do that. But but the nice thing is that we had such a wonderful turnout, and Pip and I were even talking about how many writers are in this area. It's very inspiring. What we're talking about tonight is collaboration between couples. And before I introduce myself, I'm just going to go ahead, thank you, and let the panelists introduce themselves. So why don't we start from the end? So let's go on ahead and start
great.
At the end.
So my name's Nick Kelly. I met a bunch of you guys at some of the earlier meetings this year, and I guess even into last year. I write primarily science fiction. My first book is coming out later this month. As a matter of fact, there's the cover right there. So this is my sci-fi anti-hero. If you took Blade Runner and Spider-Man and threw them together in a blender, you'd wind up with this. So that's kind of where I come from. And I have the great fortune of writing with the love of my life, Miss Stasia Kelly.
Oh, hi, all. I'm Dr. Kelly. I write both fiction and nonfiction. Six nonfiction out. My first urban fantasy fiction came out about 2 years ago. And since then, I've been editing his stuff, but also we've been collaborating on three different books in our Urban Samurai series. So we co-write together a medical examiner and who's a demon hunter by night and a samurai demon hunter and a detective who doesn't believe anything she says.
Yes.
Okay.
You're up.
I'm Philippa Pitt Ballantyne. The accent is from New Zealand. I moved here.
Thanks.
Because of him.
It's
and
not New York.
Enjoying it.
It's not New York.
Hey, does that count? I'm out of country. I write fantasy by myself, and I collaborate with T on steampunk, which is, if you don't know, Jules Verne is a very 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That's pretty much what steampunk is. I had a really exciting 2 days. I had two new books arrive.
They're brand new, they're so warm off the presses.
They're
both conclusions to series.
That's right. Yeah. This is Harbinger, which is my fourth book in the Books of the Order series. Brand spanking new. And then today I got, that was yesterday's mail, and then today's mail I got Kindred and Wings, which is my science fiction series with Pyre Books, and it's got a dragon in it, my very first dragon.
Yeah, there you go.
So it's been a very exciting couple of days. I'll let T talk about the steampunk that we do together, Ed.
Yes,
the obvious question is, does the dragon
right now,
we've got, this is the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. This is book one. Is it book two? Is it book three?
This is book three. This is the cover for the third book. And this is coming out hopefully
in January,
possibly February of next year, depending on how quickly we can do the edits. And while we're working on the edits for that, we have this anthology coming out.
Which we kickstarted.
We did a Kickstarter for this, and we'll be talking a little bit about this particular work. This is called Ministry Protocol Thrilling Tales from the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences.
Just rolls off the tongue.
It does. But I don't trip up on it. Yeah. So what I'd like to start off this conversation with is the process. What is the collaboration process between the two of you? How does it work?
We talked about this earlier in the week.
Yeah.
And now you can't remember.
No. So when we started collaborating, it was kind of, I had this idea about doing the Demon Samurai Hunter, and I wanted to put her with somebody, but I wanted to actually co-write this one. And I asked Nick, I said, do you want to write with me? And he came up with his detective to kind of counter my urban samurai.
Very black and white relationship, because he's just your sort of typical gritty TV cop detective where it's, like, he just wants to drive his really fast car and listen to classic rock, and that's great. And everything has a, you know, the clues lead to an absolute ending, and that's it. And so when the mumbo jumbo giant shrimp demons start showing up and stuff, it's like, oh, wait, I don't believe that. It's not, that didn't really happen. So
jumbo shrimp.
Yeah, so
it's supposed to be the mantis shrimp.
Yeah, you keep telling them lobster claws with tails.
Yes, but I did, because I come from such a different writing style, I did get a lot of slaps on the wrist about, that's a little too much graphic detail, so why don't you rein that in, young man? We're trying to do a romance novel here.
And it turned out to be more of a contemporary kind of mystery than romance so far. But it's turned out to be a series, too, because it went in a different direction than we originally planned. And it was kind of funny because we sit down and
there was no romance.
Not in the beginning one. I'll get with the second one. But we found out we have two very different processes when writing. I sit down and I just write. I don't have a plot in line. I don't have anything storyboarded. And he's the exact opposite. And I think it's his musician tendencies and your math tendencies that he storyboards.
The opposite,
I just write. I don't have a plan.
Oh, I have to storyboard everything. So my background's in comic books, too, so I'm used to everything being like visual into my face. And my character's sort of the writing piece that goes along with that character is it's the police procedural piece of it, right? So I can't just kind of write, because then I'll forget when I left this clue or how I'm tipping off the reader to this, that, or the other thing. And so I won't say meticulous, because that's not my style at all, but I have to get very detail-oriented. Otherwise, I'll just when I go back and edit, I'll find out how much stuff that I missed or put in at least three times. Like, oh, he's sitting up. He's standing up. He said, wait, I already did that. So.
And I don't know if you guys have noticed with you guys, but when it's us as a couple collaborating, it works much better than collaboration with other writers outside of Floyd, like on this book here, on the 9 months and 9 months out. So, but we're going to
talk about that. We've got that story. That's coming.
We're going to get into that. It's worth talking about. I mean, it is true. When people say, when people see that there are books that are put together, and the first thing they think is, well, I'd love to do that. And, you know, people think Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, they bump into one another at a con. They go, hey, let's write a book together. Boom. Suddenly you have a book. And it doesn't always quite work that way. We're not suggesting that you marry all of your partners. You know, they just passed laws concerning marriage equality. I don't think polygamy is coming in there.
Well, for editing purposes.
For editing purposes, maybe they'll go with that, because we all know how painful the editing process can be. But Pip, I'd like for you to talk for a few minutes about our process. How do we do what we do?
Well, in the Ministry series, we have much like you, a male character and a female character. T writes Wellington, I write Eliza. And at the initial stages when we wrote the first book, it was very black and white about you were writing Wellington, I was writing Eliza. And then we started to get in between characters, third characters, and then it was sort of a bit of a struggle. Who wanted to write about the deadly female Italian assassin? And we had to, I don't know how we came to an arrangement on who did that.
It was a lot of Rochambeau.
It was, yeah. it was whoever got to it first.
Yeah, rock, paper, lizard, yeah. Spock.
Right? Yes, we do that too. Yeah.
And we do a lot of what you would call spitballing sessions where we sit down and think about what if this would happen, and there's a lot of really cool stuff where you suddenly go, hey, I've got a great idea, and then the other person grabs it and works on that, and before you know it, you've got a plot. We sort of do a version of, yeah, what you do is pantsing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what you do is plotting. And in between, there is one called discovery writing, which is where you know that there's going to be a final scene, and you know that you're going to get there, but you don't know how to get there. So it sort of combines a bit of the spontaneity.
We do that sometimes too.
Yeah.
That's the chapter where
I think T and I both do that. That's our form of...
It's the pro wrestling approach to the writing process. You know who's going to win the match, you just don't know how many headlocks are going to be involved. Right? Exactly, right.
And
The other thing that Pip is forgetting is that we will write separate chapters, but then we will go back.
I was getting to that.
Very good. Go ahead.
Don't edit me before I'm finished.
It's so easy to do, though.
So then once we've done that, we flip. So I edit T's stuff, he edits mine. I read characters. You know, I mean, we write each other's characters. So sometimes I go a bit and I say, Eliza doesn't talk like that, and change it.
When you guys have a scene where the characters are together, how do you guys do that?
We usually sit down and talk to each other, and we do like the dialogue.
What's that like?
That's one of the things is people like the snappy dialogue, so that's usually how we sit down and just talk about it and say, oh, well, I come back with this.
And usually I'm going, write it down, baby, write it down.
That's where we learn that in Google Docs.
Yes.
That's how we do it, because otherwise I start losing what we were talking about.
Right.
Yeah, I have to write it down.
And then, of course, but they're the probably the toughest things for us to write are the interludes. The interludes are where we bring in the third characters and things like that. Because we're not coming from Eliza's point of view, we're not coming from Wellington's point of view. It could be a woman, it could be a man, and we're trying to find that happy medium where it's still the same voice, and that was the next thing that
I think in the first book it was harder to do, and it's got easier.
Well, it was harder to do too because of the logistics of how we were writing. I was in the United States at the time. Pip was in New Zealand. So the good news was during the writing process, we had literally 24 hours of production because I would be awake. We would have that magic hour where she was waking up, I was going to bed, and I would say, look, we spitballed ideas, then I'd go to sleep, wake up the next morning.
Very efficient if you want to get things done. I highly recommend it. Except... Except when you get to the editing stage.
Particularly how Harper Voyager did it.
Yes, we had a red pen experience editing Harper Voyager, which when you're doing a collaboration is very difficult, to put it mildly. Luckily, we've moved publishers over to Penguin, so they are a little bit more with it as far as editing.
So with Nick and Stasia, one of the things I wanted to ask was about the collaborations that happen beyond the manuscript, the collaborations that are with from an editorial perspective or an artistic perspective. What are your experiences with that?
For us, we haven't really. I think the only challenge we ran into was the cover. Ryan's shirt was the wrong color.
No, hold on. No. The reason that we didn't have a ton of headbutting and jockeying for position is because Stacia's master's degree is in writing. My degree is in criminal justice. So when it gets to the editing process and she knows all the rules of writing that I don't know, I just like to tell a story and whack a couple people along the way. It's just kind of like, here you go. Like, even with my book, I'm like, you can edit it and I'll go back and read it later. Because if I go in and make these editing suggestions, she's like, sounds great, but it's wrong. Oh, never mind.
It's close.
Yes.
The commas.
Oh, commas. I'm only now learning about the commas. Oh.
But yeah, and our cover artist was great. She took our ideas. Chip has Heidi's as a cover artist too. Mm-hmm. And she ran with it. And I only ever have to go back and do a few tweaks with her. or anything like that. So we haven't really run into any of the issues for our collaboration.
But how do you collaborate? I mean, is it the same kind of process where you spitball ideas, or was it a collaboration that you didn't quite expect? I mean, I guess that's the word I'm looking for.
I think the phrase that you captured was hot tub brainstorming sessions, which I really liked. Which is, I've got this idea, and this character's totally stuck. What are we going to do? Let's go talk it out in the hot tub. Let's just go chill out. So then it's, oh, well, what about this? What about this? Okay, how are we going to take notes? We're in a hot tub. That's not going to work. So
20 minutes later, I'm like, okay, I got to go write all that down.
Yeah, right.
I hate it when you're like lying in bed and talking about it, and then you're like, so who's going to go and write that down? I'm not.
No, see, I don't.
We'll remember in the morning.
Yeah, so it started out where he's actually changed my writing style over to plotting more so for going forward. So I ended up going back and taking the timeline software and timelining out everything for the book so that I had all, because it covers a long history, and then the shorter story being their togetherness, and I had to go back and fix things and tweak things.
So what about from your perspective, Pip, the kind of collaborations, because when people say I'm collaborating, at least from my perspective, I've never felt that writing, you'll hear people say writing is a solitary act. You're writing in a bubble, you're writing alone, but really you're not. Because you have the editor to deal with, you've got the publicity to deal with, you've got, depending on which press you go to, particularly if it's with an independent house, you're dealing with the publisher. You're dealing with the publisher one-on-one in some cases. So for you, Pip, I mean, in your experiences, like for cover art, did you have any collaborations with the people putting together the cover?
It sort of varied. Penguin came up with this wonderful cover artist named Jason Chan. They asked me they asked me quite a bit. They were like, do you have any reference images, colors, what do you see on the cover? And then they went away and they came, every cover that Jason did, I was just like, I can't change a thing. With Kindred and Wings, this is actually a local lady, Cynthia Shepherd. I think she lives in Fairfax, strangely enough. But she did the covers of this book and the first one. The only change was actually from our child, who said the nose was a little more, she said, it looks like a pig. So I had child collaboration, so they went and changed her.
Oh, for about you, my nonfiction, Brandon's actually picked out a couple of the covers.
Yeah,
for the last two.
I think children are very honest about what they see.
What's fantastic is hearing Hugo winning editor Lou Anders look at the cover and go,
yeah,
damn it, she's right. Yeah, so, you know, and then with Dawn's Early Light, I remember they were saying, yes, what do you want on the cover? And I remember saying, I don't know how you're going to pull this off.
Airships.
What we'd like to see are airships. We turn a lighthouse into a death ray. So could
death
you do
ray
that?
Lighthouse.
And if possible, make sure Wellington isn't looking straight on, because we have we wound up having this running gag throughout all three of our covers, and you'll notice it when you go from Peculiar Currents from Phoenix Rising up to this one. You never see Wellington's face. It is usually obscured by something.
That's why he's got a teacup.
He's drinking tea. In the Janus affair, he's holding his bowler. And in this one, he's looking over his shoulder. And when we got this, we were like, they did. And we were stunned, because a lot of times you don't get that kind of say, and you don't get that kind of a collaboration. One of the other kind of collaborations, though, that I think Pip and I enjoyed was from the marketing aspect of it, whether it was with the publisher from our previous publisher, Dragon Moon Press, or Harper Voyager and now Ace, when it came to marketing the books, which is the toughest thing to do, is marketing. We were asked, well, what plans do you have? And we said, well, with your permission, we would like to do some podcasting, which is what we're doing tonight. We're recording this for podcasting. But particularly for the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, we worked with the Harper Voyager marketing team to get out the word as best as possible about that. And what we were doing was, is we had other authors working with us they would record a short story for us. We would then give it some treatment. We would throw in some music and some sound effects. We'd record a customized introduction for that story, and then we'd release it. And what Harper Voyager did was they would put something on their blog about it. They would retweet. They would put something on Tumblr about it. They would help us publicize this free audio fiction that we were giving away on our website. And it's that kind of thing that that when you get into a collaboration, whether it's with other people, whether it's with on your own, you should remember that this process is not just between author and author. You're eventually going to work with another editor. You're going to eventually work with a cover artist. It's good to know what your hive mind is thinking. Which brings us to collaboration gone bad. I'm going to send this over to Stasia because she's got some stories about, and I've got some stories about what happens when good ideas go south.
Yeah. So we had the book, one of the first nonfiction ones that we published was 9 months in, 9 months out, and there are four authors on here, all experts in their field, which means they all know what's right. And so the challenge was I was the only writer in the group. And trying to get them together was like herding cats. Mm-hmm. We had a nutritionist specialist. We had myself with the stress management piece that I was working on. We had the fitness expert, and we had a
midwife.
So everybody, and I always forget the midwife.
I know, I'm here to, we're playing Mad Libs.
That's how he does it. they didn't know how to use technology either. So that's the other key, too, is make sure that your writing partner knows how to use the technology that you are going to be using going forward for editing or writing back and forth. And they don't like to stick to deadlines. Easy for us to just stick to deadlines. We live together. I can hunt him down.
You know where he sleeps.
I know where he sleeps. His desk is right there next to mine. But these ladies, you know, they have schedules. They're busy. They're delivering babies. And they're not writing things down. And then having to go back and double check, fact check. Because I had to make sure they weren't plagiarizing anything, because they were taking notes out of other things too, and just sending them my way, expecting me to do all the work. And then also with this one, our publisher was a small press publisher, local lady, love her to death. This is the first time she'd been doing publishing for anything other than her own books and focusing on more military style stories. So she wasn't quite sure what to do with us as far as the medical one. And we had a title backwards on the spine, which Pip said, hey, to work in Germany, I think was
yes, Germans have their titles the other way around.
So it was worked perfectly there. And it was a long process. It took, they didn't understand publishing. They thought we would get it done and I would find a publisher and it would be done out on the market in a year. Mm-hmm. It took 3 years to get the book written. And all the while I was doing all the work trying to find a publisher and everything else, we finally found the publisher, and then it took her 6 months to get everything formatted, laid out, designed. The nice thing is that the cover is actually one of the moms who helped write the book.
It's very pretty.
That's the fitness model. She was by the time the book was published, she had her second one. She was like, that was her first.
So it was still current.
It was still current. But yeah, it was a nightmare, and we decided that between the four of us, the next iteration, 9 months and beyond, Corey and I will write together on our own rather than having the other two in there too, because it was just so hard to get them to focus and to participate.
I think if we did a show of hands, don't really raise your hand, please, because I don't want to embarrass
you.
Because
that really doesn't work on audio. It doesn't.
Oh, my God, T, everybody's hand is up.
1,000 people
if,
here.
If you asked a group of writers, who just wants to write, who doesn't want to get into all the marketing, the publicity, and all the other stuff that comes once the book's done, we'd have a whole bunch of hands. I heard some people laughing already. Right? We'd have a whole bunch of hands shoot up. Now you can imagine doing that with four writers on a book that is not their primary means of income. So yeah, it was a little bit.
He was listening to me vent about it the entire time. I'm like, these people are not getting their stuff to me. We're not getting things done. And eventually, the funny thing is the publisher gave us back the rights to the book. So all the work I'd been doing anyway, I'm doing still. So I think I sold more books than our publisher did.
Oh, easily.
And that's been an interesting challenge. So with the four people, I'd recommend knowing them really well and making sure that they're going to stick to their deadlines.
Yeah.
The part about knowing people well, I cannot stress how important that is.
Oh, this is good.
Like I said, we all went to Ground Central and they said, well, so what kind of bad story? And the reason why I specifically wanted to bring this up, we just did this for the James River blog. I made sure that there was a section in there about collaboration going bad, because you rarely hear about that.
And how you can avoid it.
Mm-hmm. And one of them is get to know reading people. Get to read people really well, because you know, hindsight 2020. My first warning was when I was working with this very young woman. Again, different hemisphere. She was in Malaysia. We wound up clicking and writing back and forth this incredible epic fantasy adventure, and we were having a blast with it. I really enjoyed it. And then I said, you know, we really have a, I think we can really make, we can sell this. And she said, well, I was talking with my aunt who is a lawyer, and she says we should write up an agreement to make sure that if something goes wrong, you know, that we're covered. And I thought, sure. So I went on ahead, I designed the whole thing, I signed it, I sent it to her. And 2 weeks later, she said, I got the agreement. Wow, you really did it. And I said, yeah, so when are you gonna sign, copy, and send it back to me? She said, oh, I just wanted to see if you would do it. Now, that was my first warning. My second warning was when
I never got
it back. But the second warning came when we went on a radio show together. It was a radio show, and we through some skullduggery we networked telephones, so that this was before the days of Skype and things like that when Skype would work, and we networked in all of us. So it was for the first time. It was me, it was my partner Lisa, and it was these two radio talk show hosts in Phoenix. And I said, Lisa, this is your first interview. It was her first interview ever. First interview. And I said, all you have to do is be yourself. That's all you have to do. But there's one other thing that you have to do. Do not talk about the sequel. We haven't written word one on the sequel. We haven't even mapped out an outline for the sequel or an idea of where we're going to go. So let's go on ahead. And let's just talk about this book and our experiences. Sure enough, so what are you guys working on next? Boom, she mentions we're gonna work on the sequel. Fast forward to a time,
this is the Cliff Notes version.
There's an epic tale to this that involves a lot of money, lawyers, and things like that. But it gets worse because fast forward to a point of where I want to rewrite the epic adventure, play to my strengths, rewrite it in steampunk. Do the same thing, but just, you know, advance the characters, put it in steampunk, same plot, few tweaks here and there, no big deal. But I have to get her blessing. I have to get it in writing. So I just do a Hail Mary pass online, and I go to the place that you go when you can't find somebody, Facebook. There she is. And I say to her, Lisa, look, I want to move forward with this. I want to move forward with this story, and I would really, really like it if you would just sign off on it, because, you know, I haven't heard from you. You cut off communication to me. I could care less at this point. I'm thinking about my career. I want to move forward. You're obviously not writing, so let's, you know, would you be okay with that? The response I got was this very detailed mea culpa about how the reason why she cut off all ties was because she was embarrassed by the book. She was embarrassed by this thing we did, this accomplishment. This book that was actually nominated for ebook awards when ebooks weren't even cool. When we were garnering attention for the podcast, first book to ever be podcast from cover to cover. And I said, so then you don't have any qualms signing off. She was like, oh, I can't do that. I love these characters too much. And that was when I realized this is all about you. This is all about your control and your ability to get in the last word with me. So I went, all right. And that was the last communication I had with her. I started the rewrite of the epic fantasy anyway, renamed the characters, killed the elves in a bloodbath, and am now in the process of rewriting this steampunk story with my characters still intact, only now instead of working for King Henry VIII, they're working for Queen Victoria. And it's all set in modern, or rather, Victorian day China.
So you're saying that you should have gotten her to sign?
That's the thing. Have an exit plan. We actually talked to a lawyer when we were getting our wills done about what's going to happen with the rights to the book, things of that nature. It's stuff that you really don't want to talk about. It's stuff that's depressing, particularly when you're writing amongst friends, but it's essential. It is essential, because if something goes wrong,
or if somebody doesn't want to keep doing it anymore,
because that was what happened with you.
Yeah, mine was not nearly as dramatic.
No, it wasn't. No.
But I mean, I started writing a collaboration with a friend online, and we got about halfway through, and then he suddenly dropped off the map. Then he came back as a social media guru, and I was able to find him again. But he was nice enough to say, "Here's my blessing. Go and it's all yours. Whatever we did." So it wasn't nearly as bad. But yeah, have some sort of idea of what you're going to do if you get if one of you gets bored.
And even if you're marrying your partner, you're going to have to deal with that. You are going to have to deal with, okay, let's say the two of us, you know, go different directions. You know, we got two choices. Hankery-pankery happens and you wind up on the ID channel, or you go on ahead and you say, all right.
I'll have Eliza and you have Wellington. There
exactly.
You go.
I have Eliza and Wellington. And there shall the two meet. But having that exit plan, whether it is between friends or whether it is between loved ones, you have to have that in place. You have to have that in place before you move forward.
I don't think lack of interest is the only thing either. I mean, you've got to have something in there in case somebody just doesn't hit the deadline, right? You know what I mean? Like if all of a sudden, you know, you lose the book deal because one of the partners got writer's block and decided, I just can't keep going with this. I'm stuck. Or just something else got in the way. Something bright, shiny got in the way.
But that comes back to communication. Yeah. That comes back to communication. If you've got a good example is we had a prominent for the Ministry of Anthology. We had a prominent New York Times bestseller, one of the cornerstones of fantasy literature, joining us, and we got three confirmations that this author was on board. And then when it came to when are we going to get to see the first draft, all communication stopped. And we said, well, we got two choices. We're going to have to delay the project, and I can keep leaning on this author, or we're going to have to move forward. And as much as it hurt, I said, we're moving forward. And this was a very humbling experience too. In collaborations, particularly with other authors, you find out just not only meaning the word pro, but the meaning of the word fan. Because we asked this one author, Delilah S. Dawson, who is also a steampunk author, we said, look, we need this story within 3 weeks. Can you do it? She gave it to us in two. And for 2 weeks, we heard about, oh, I'm so excited! You know, and we were like, really? And it's hard, but you have to have some kind of exit plan.
Yeah, I think we were joking about it. Coming from the comic book world, where it was, if you need something by April 1st, you tell the artist you need it by February 1st.
And if it's March 1st, they'll put it together. Going back to unexpected collaborations, I want to have Pip take the mic and talk a little bit about the way she collaborates with other bloggers for cover reveals and blog tours. And actually, go ahead and describe that a little bit about blog tours and cover reveals. What exactly are those?
Okay, so T and I go to a lot of conventions, and we meet a lot of people, and the most valuable ones, I think, that we have met, apart from other authors, are book bloggers. In this day and age, people's friends and who they turn to for recommendations. So anyway, I've got these two books and they're coming out within 2 weeks of each other. Panic. I want to market both of them.
Oh yeah, and you've got an anthology.
And I've got an
too.
Anthology. So I start to realize that I cannot possibly put my marketing efforts into both of these equally. So I actually ended up hiring a lady called Roxanne, who has a marketing group called Bewitching Tours.
Bewitching Book Tours.
And she does, she's done cover reveals of these, which is basically where you send them the cover, and on a set date, Roxanne gets all of her book bloggers to go, look, isn't it amazing?
I may have just hired her yesterday, by the way.
Yes. This is amazing. And then you get all these people going, ooh, that's interesting, I've never seen that author before. Ooh. And then what I've done is I've booked with Roxanne two-week blog tours for each of these books, which is incredibly draining on the brain, but very useful because she organizes, as you said, herding cats. Mm-hmm. Book bloggers are also somewhat similar to authors in that respect. So she gets everybody organized, sends them the cover, the back copy, all of that. Then she sends you a list of the book bloggers and says, this is what they'd like to ask you, either interviews, you write a guest post about finishing a book. And
how do you two work together in that respect? How do you work with the book bloggers to get them content, to find out what they want?
Well, because of Roxanne, I'm dealing with Roxanne. And Roxanne distributes it out to all the book bloggers, which makes it a little bit easier.
Did she put out the red light?
Yes, she did not.
Good.
She does not work
with police fans out there.
She will, however, publicize your book for money.
There you go.
I was singing that song.
Yeah.
Does she specialize in fiction?
Yes. Mostly sort of urban fantasy, you know.
Romance.
Romance, that sort of thing. Cost-wise, I think a cover reveal was like $35, which pretty good. And I think the two-week blog tour was like 70?
Somewhere in the 60-70 range.
60-70 range.
The month was 110.
Yes, the most expensive one was like 110, which was a month-long blog tour, which I think would drain your brain entirely.
If we had one book, I would say a month-long tour wouldn't be bad.
Yes, with two, but within 2 weeks.
When you got two plus the anthology coming, that's when you have to say, I can't do that.
So she's sort of basically a part-time PA that you purchase for that set amount of time, and that's awesome.
And I want to talk to about since you've heard us talk about collaborating with other authors with anthologies, we're not the only ones that do this. Stassi and Nick, they have a spinoff of a series.
So our Urban Samurai series, it started out 12 samurai sisters, and I was going to write each sister. Well, the sisters have taken on lives of their own, and I had a few friends say, well, I'd love to write with you with that one. So she started, one of my friends picked up Treat, she picked up Raisa and...
Kirian,
and went in a totally different direction with Kirian than I thought she would. I gave her the outline of these are the two characters. This is what they. This is who they are. This is their background. These are their names. This is what they're doing. I will write the sister because I developed the sister already, and because she was already a part of the first book, Itchy, that's coming out in November, and she went off and I got the start of the story back and went, whoa, okay.
But in a good way,
well,
right?
Yeah, it was, yeah, yes. But it was not how I had interpreted his character. I hadn't built his background except for a very high level. And she went into all the details, like how he got where he was and everything. And I was like, okay.
And this is a beautiful thing when you not only communicate with your authors, particularly with anthologies, but also when you trust your authors in your world. For us, the good and the bad came from a dear friend of mine from podcasting, from writing. His name is Jack Mangan, and he's written two short stories, one for the podcast and one for the anthology, both set with the same characters. But it was that whole trust issue. He said, I'm going to check this for canon. We're like, yeah, sure, that's fine. And all we really had about the ministry was set in Victorian London, so there's our world building. And then we have this ministry of peculiar occurrences. Anything else, you know, it's up to us. No matter the reputation of the author or our relationship with the author, we had to pull them back if we needed to. Where we let Jack run was when two of our agents, the Australian agent, first name's Bruce, last name Campbell. So we have an agent, Bruce Campbell, and his partner, Brandon Hill. They're going through America. And they come across the equivalent of the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences in America. Even cooler, he said, so who are you with? And he goes, awesome. And he goes, I'm sorry, what makes you so special? He goes, no, awesome. The Office of the Supernatural and Metaphysical. We ran with this idea. And they are prominently featured in the third book, whom we're dedicating the third book to Jack. Because if it wasn't for that idea, for that trust, we were like, we would have never, brilliant. But where I had to pull him back, for those of you who are fellow geeks, you probably recognize the name Bruce Campbell from Army of Darkness, and Jack's a huge fan. And at one point, Jack says, he has Bruce say, someone say to Bruce Campbell's character, are all the agents of the ministry as rakish as you? And he goes, just me, baby. Just me. Now, being a Bruce Campbell fan, I'm like, it yanks me straight out. But the and he did it again for the anthology. So to throw him a bone, to say, okay, Jack, I'm going to give you this one, is there was a clearance code that Bruce Campbell had to give.
He taps
in the second word, and he goes, so he doesn't remember the third one, so he just taps out the best one. So his partner comes up and goes, Bruce, when are you going to learn it? Nikto. The last word of the code is Nikto, which goes back to Army of Darkness.
Darkness.
And I got this little note back from Jack going, well played, Mr. Morris. So he got his wish. He got his Army of Darkness.
That's so
wish.
Funny.
So there are some good sides to go.
There are some wonderful, wonderful things to do with collaboration. But I'm going to throw it out there that I think the two biggest things you have to have to really make it work are trust and communication. Do you have anything else you want to add to that? And then we're going to turn it over for questions.
Trust communication and your timeline.
Yeah. We invented one of those recently.
Yeah, just recently.
Yeah, just the time, just the timeline of like what's going to happen, because we write every November together.
Right.
So we do NaNoWriMo every year. I started out in 2004 with it. I kept going with it, and then he joined me, and then we started working on the books together that way. But a timeline as far as, because otherwise it disappears into the netherland of everyday life, and to when you want to have it done. So.
Yeah,
just like any
those.
Project.
Yeah, we do.
I was going to say it's the same thing that makes an effective partnership or an effective marriage work, which are, you know, trust and communication. And I don't know where the hell timeline
and deadlines.
Timeline. I'm not sure where that goes.
Who's going to scoop the kitty litter tonight?
That's why we write really fast.
Exactly.
I'm too busy. I'm writing. Sorry.
Deadline.
Dinner's not my responsibility.
So one problem writing in the summer, because someone has gotten used to me grilling every night, so that happens.
Okay.
So with that being said, we'd like to turn it over to you all for questions. So we'll take this question over here. You're probably going to hear me repeat it if it turns out too faint, but go ahead.
It seems that you all have figured out how to separate your responsibilities. Like, you're the writer slash editor, you're the plot developer, you're the one character, you're a different character. Did that just come out naturally, or how did that division of responsibilities come out?
Well, with the two of us, the original idea of what the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences was going to be was it was supposed to be a spin-off podcast of a book that I will never write. But at the time, I had written the first chapter and a half, and Pip said, I want to do a podcast, and I want to do it for pay. And we're going to give out the first five for free, then we'll start doing like $1 an episode or something like that, you know. So what we'll do is I'll write it from Eliza's point of view, and I'll record it, and you write from Wellington's point of view, and you record it. And I thought, that sounds great. And then it became a novel, and we just decided to just keep writing in that fashion, and it just kind of stuck after that.
And then it became awesome.
Then it became awesome.
That was editing. we are two authors that will never, ever, ever bitch or moan about the editing process, because that's when you cut away the rough and you find that hope diamond in the center.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think, Pip?
Hmm? Oh, about our process? Yes, it just sort of naturally evolved. It's got better and better. I mean, I think the first novel was more of a struggle. We got by the second book, we were getting quite good at yelling at each other about who was right. We do have the occasional argument about we wanted to kill a character. You actually won that argument.
But the biggest argument we ever had, you stepped me right into that story. Yeah. That biggest argument now, as you hear
Cliff
about,
Notes version.
Cliff Notes with addendums. So Pip, as you can tell by, you know, she's not from New York. She's got the New Zealand accent. Now, in New York, they take their baseball very, very seriously. It's the same in New Zealand, but not baseball, it's rugby. It's all about the All Blacks. So we have a scene in the Janus Affair where Wellington breaks the rules in rugby to impress Eliza, but also to one-up this rather, you know, bombastic character. And I wrote the scene. I asked Pip specifically, I said, Pip, if I wanted to do an illegal move in rugby, what's the best thing to do? She goes, oh, well, you do X, Y, Z, blah, blah. I said, okay. So I took some notes, wrote it down, made it really dramatic, made it really gruesome. And I hand it to, and I hand over the scene, and I'm doing something else. And suddenly goes, T, we have a problem. And I'm like, oh, boy. So I sit down and go, what's the problem? Well, T, Wellington breaks the rules here in rugby. I go, yeah, I know. It's a character flaw. It's a device. It's showing that he's... Pip sits there and she goes, but you don't understand. He breaks the rules of rugby. And I went, yeah, Pip, he's breaking the rules on purpose. He can't do this. He would get kicked out. I'm like, yeah, I don't see the point in this. And
then, well, I let you have it in the end because he wasn't a New Zealand character. So it was okay. He was English.
And this is when I really wish we were doing video podcasting so you could see the movement.
The outrage.
Yes. What about you two?
Oh, nothing like that.
we have the fun that we have is some of the fight scenes. Because I'm a martial artist.
Yes. Yeah.
I actually, there are times that I will make him go through the scene with me to make sure that it will work.
Yes. Go put on the suit, Nick. It's time to get kicked.
So I think the worst was me accidentally breaking his rib while we were practice sparring.
Okay, hold on.
So we had to suffer
for
that.
For the listeners, air quotes run accidentally. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, snap.
Not sure if that
apparently my foot knows the exact place to hit.
Of course, that was probably when one of your kids ran in going, "You're killing Dad!"
No, when he puts the suit on, Dad, he's allowed to practice.
Oh, yeah, I'm fair game. When the suit's on, everybody just lines up. I think it comes from, you know, you recognize where your strengths are early on, right? So, like, if I was writing music and I'll go write the hook and the song, and this is great, and then the guitar player can write the guitar solo, I'm not going to write it for him. Same thing with kind of like, okay, this is your character. You're going to do the romance stuff probably a lot better than I am because you've
written it.
All of those. Yeah, and written it, right? So, and then, you know, when someone needs to get a really gruesome death scene, then I can write that stuff. But then, you know, again, going to the editing process where it was kind of like, okay, honey, I know you've gone through this 3 times, but you keep undoing this correction and you can't do that. Oh, okay, well, you do it. So I think that's kind of where we sort of leveled out, right?
Yeah, well, for us too, you have to understand, we've always worked together. Like, we entered the workforce working together in the dialysis facility, so we kind of tend to carry that through in our writing, I think, and in our lifestyle in general. So people always ask me, how can you work with your husband? I'm like, I think I always have worked with him.
It's also something that I think it happens in our writing. Even in our solo writing, Pip will be bouncing ideas off of me. There was a short story Pip was working on where it was set in Studio 51 in the 80s, and it was about 3 succubi. And the succubus, and I said, well, if they're wandering through and they're checking people out, you got to have them see Andy Warhol, I'm mistaken for a vampire. And sure enough, you know, they were like one of the succubi turns to the other one. It was basically like, you know, Sex in the City.
But with succubi.
With demons.
Yeah. Demons.
And she had one of the characters go, who's the vamp in the corner? And she goes, oh, wow, you're in a real mood. That's just Andy. You know, and it was done. It was just this every time I heard it, she did it as a podcast. Every time I heard that, I just grinned because I'm like, yeah, there's my thumbprint.
There you go.
Any other questions? We're just going to get one. Oh, here we go.
How did you two meet since it was obviously online?
Yes.
Like, how did you connect as far as writers?
Pip wanted a mail order bride. And
hello, my name is Dee. I live in Siberia. I make Jaegers out of tanks and vodka. Sorry, go ahead.
I was sorely misled. T and I actually know each other through writing for like 10, 12 years now.
Yeah. In an online writer's group.
Yes. I sold my first book in 2002 to a small Canadian independent press called Dragon Moon. And there was this bombastic guy on some sort of listserv thing.
He just had his book come out in 2002.
And it sounded similar. And so I was like, oh, I better talk to him about that. And then we were friends for the longest time, and then T was like, well, everybody wants to collaborate with me.
And I didn't realize I did not realize until much later, yeah, they did. They wanted to collaborate with me because I was a marketing machine. I was writing, at one time I was writing 2 press releases a week.
We should collaborate.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing was, things had ended so bitterly with Lisa Lee that I had no desire to collaborate with anybody. And when I still remember the conversation Pip and I had concerning Ministry Peculiar Occurrences, I remember saying to Pip, I said, Pip, I would love to collaborate with you, but you gotta promise me something. Promise me that we will not be at each other's throats and that I will regret this. And Pip said, shut up and collaborate.
I said, I don't want to do all the work. You're going to help me on this, okay?
The fact that she was being that upfront made me feel like, a lot better.
Yeah, because the podcast for pay thing, I was like, it's very experimental. It still is, really.
Timey-wimey.
Yeah, so I thought, I don't want to waste all of my time doing this. I'll waste some of somebody else's.
But that was how we met, was through Dragon Moon Press. As a matter of fact, I remember it was when I was launching the sequel to the epic, the sequel that I wrote by myself. And my publisher, Gwen Gates of Dragon Moon, basically said, take a book home, you know, take a couple of books home. And she had just released a whole bunch of these books. And the one that struck me was at the very top. It was Pip's book, which was called Chasing the Bard. And I'm a huge Shakespeare fan, and I said, yeah, I'll take this one. And I didn't put it down. And that,
that was funny because I read, you sent me an early copy of one of your, of Moravia.
Oh, you were so mad at me. She was so
T,
mad at
me. So T sends me this copy of his book, which is set in Tudor England with Henry VIII. And there's Shakespeare. And I'm like, that's
it was
not right.
Totally gratuitous. Totally gratuitous.
I was like, I don't want to say anything.
Didn't
but that's
it,
wrong.
Didn't make it to the final copy.
I was so relieved when I saw it. I was like, oh, phew, that was close.
I bet you were.
These days I would tell you if I didn't like it.
Yes, you do.
I've got over that.
Any other questions? Yeah. Again, from over here.
All of you have talked about editing as though you do all your own editing. Is that the case? Usually that's pretty hard to edit your own stuff.
Nope. No, I edit professionally as well for nonfiction. I edit our stuff first. I go through the first round, and then we have an editor separate. Because you do, I figure you miss like 70% of your own errors.
Yeah, you get sort of blindness to your own.
Right.
70% or
70%?
70.
Yes, that's a large.
It's an important number.
You miss about 70% of your own editing errors if you're so drawn into the story, you're so used to it.
Kind of skips ahead. Yeah. Fills in the blanks.
I also use a program, online program called Autocrit.com. Mm.
Autocrit.
C-R-I-T. Autocrit.com. It is a huge help in capturing grammar errors and repetitive sentences and repetitive words because we write the way we talk a lot of times, and so I have to go back and fix and take out just and that and all these little things that keep repeating or phrases that you like to use over and over again. They come across too often.
Yeah.
Huffed.
Yeah. Huffed.
That's your one.
Mine's it's a yearly course. Fee of $100-some dollars. But I use it for everything. It gives you these great reports. It's online.
As far as how we do edit ourselves because we're both of a firm believers that if anyone says, yes, you don't have to worry about editing this, it's good on the first draft. Yeah, okay.
Oh, no.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I've heard it. But, I mean, even the greats, you know, Stephen King, Faulkner and so forth, they'll write something, but then they'll go back and they'll reread it. We will always have another editor because you do need that fresh set of eyes. But
a good beta first readers,
Yeah.
And beta readers.
Yeah, beta readers. Yeah.
Those are key too because they a lot of our guys. We've got a MIT grad, PhD grad, who reads our urban fantasy stuff because he loves Dungeons and Dragons. So he likens it to that. And he goes through it and he tells me where the plot holes are. And he's quite
And it gives you a feel for your audience too, right? Because, I mean, yeah. I gave mine out to a number of beta readers and as a result, a couple people didn't make it out of the book. Like there's not enough people dead in your book. Okay, I'll go fix that. No problem. So that means I have a pretty morbid reader base, I think.
What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You got it. You can't. I wouldn't just stop at us editing our stuff.
Yeah.
How do you know when it's enough? How do you know when you've gone over it enough times? Because there's an interesting challenge.
It's
didn't prep this one.
It's just like when you do an oil painting, it's never perfect. You just abandon it.
Well, we actually feel the words of Peter Jackson when he was filming the original Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think he said it best. He said, there's a point where you have to stop editing, you have to stop filming, you have to stop, and then you have to stop editing what you've just edited and make sure that you're telling a good story. I think, and I feel that I apply that with a lot of the stuff, whether it's short form or long form or halfway in between. The one thing I wanna try to make sure of is that everything that happens in the story that there's a flow to it. There's not some glaring omission of, oh wait, they did, how did they get from A to B? Provided there's a logical progression from A to B, and I think that's where the second editor comes in. You edit your own stuff to an extent because you don't want to turn it over to the editor and have the editor go, what a hack. I mean, you want to make sure that what you're giving is presentable. But the editor is key to that. There was a in the third book, Dawn's Early Light. The editor from Ace basically said, you know, this was fun. I had a blast. I was laughing out loud. But I need more detective work. And we saw what she meant because there was a scene in this pub where it was just by happenstance that Eliza found this key to getting to the next part of the mystery. And we're like, Yeah, that's not detectable.
That's stretching it a little bit.
That's stretching it.
So too convenient, right? So like convenient writing just drives me nuts.
Why look? Here it is. Right? So what we did was I was rewriting the scene and then writing this the subsequent two chapters that followed, and in those sequences we took this very small character, and we suddenly gave him this background. And since we were talking earlier about playing to the home audience. His name was Merle, and I said, "What's Merle short for?" So I looked it up, short for Merlin, which was a huge name in the 19th century. So we called him Merlin. I think it was like Merlin Hatfield, also known as the magician, also known as the magician of Manassas, because of the third battle of Manassas. He wound up pulling this incredible flank move that the Union soldiers didn't see, and they said he's a wizard. Let's call him and he was known as the, when they find him, he's this old haggard dude. And they go, so if he was the magician, and so Wellington says to the American agents, so if he was the magician of Manassas, what happened to him? And they both look at each other, look back at Wellington, they go, Sherman's March. That's all I had to say, and I got goosebumps. And I'm like, okay, one for the home team, yeah, Virginia, represent. So, but that is part of the editorial process. What you're giving to the editor is presentable,
as clean as you can get it.
But it should nowhere be. If an editor comes back to you and says, this is perfect, don't touch a thing, find a new editor.
I remember the first time I got edited, I cried. And then but now I love my editors. I love it when I get the stuff and they're like, why is this character doing this? I love a good firm editing.
And the editing process in high school and college always terrified me. And then once I got over that, now I was being out in the field.
It's almost exciting.
Okay, great. Somebody else got to look at this other than me for the last 6 months.
See what they said.
I had about a dozen.
Yeah.
Where am I? Yeah, but it was everything
agent.
This is my first, so yeah.
Yeah.
So I fluctuate between 4 and 12.
I don't count editors. I mean, just count people who just read this and tell me what you think, and it's a very, very,
and
varying audience.
And you have to be very distinct with when you hand over the book, whether you want them beta reading or you want them editing. Mm. Because I've had beta readers come back and try to edit, and I'm like, no, that's not what I wanted you to do. I wanted you to read it and find where the gaps were. I don't want you redlining it because you're making me nutty. I'm already doing that. And if I've given it to you to beta read, I'm already doing the editing, going back and cleaning up even more and the rest of it, or it's gone to the editor for that aspect of it. But you have to be very distinct in what you're asking them to do.
We have between 5 to 10, and there are like 3 that are always go-tos for us because we know that they're not only dear friends, but they're also incredibly harsh because they want this story to be as best as possible so they can brag that, I saw it when it wasn't that good. That's awesome. So,
I saw it before then.
Yeah, exactly.
So these are mostly friends. You're not paying anybody to read your book.
Not.
Yeah.
Beta readers, no.
Okay. Yeah. You gotta
what are you doing when you're not writing?
Professional
job hunter.
I'm a professional job hunter.
I do proposal writing and editing and proposal management, as well as freelance writing for blogs, for whatever's the written word is, on social media stuff, because we're all of us pretty live on Twitter and Facebook, those kinds of things, and a holistic health coach. That's my other lifestyle.
Yep. So I work in computer security and I play in a band. So I get a chance to collaborate with all kinds of different talent. It's a lot of fun.
This is it.
All right.
And that's it.
Lucky you. Yeah. But you're the goal for the rest of us. So
I do
it's all right
laundry
then,
on
so.
The side.
It's kind of odd how I fell into what I do, which is I do social media professionally. And how that started was that I was a consultant. I was teaching different software applications, and then I was podcasting that epic fantasy I was talking about. And then I got approached by the For Dummies people to write a book for podcasting. So I wrote Podcasting for Dummies. I then went on to write 3 more books in social media, and then I went into corporate social media, which I have been doing full-time since 2009. Currently, I'm job hunting, and that is what I do is social media which has really had a nice bleed over between helping with the marketing of the books as well. We could easily come back here and do a social media panel, mm-hmm. which is something that I think all authors not only should do, but also should be aware of, because as Orson Scott Card can tell you, that can make or break an upcoming motion picture. it's very important to be. In fact, speaking of social media, another guy who's really good in social media, his name is John Scalzi, and I recommend
CIFRA president.
Science Fiction Writers of America president. I highly recommend going to John Scalzi's blog today, because he talked about the boycott that some people are planning concerning Orson Scott Card's movie. In a nutshell, what he said was he doesn't mind what Orson Scott Card said. He said, "Hey, look, it's America. You have a right to say it. But when you come back and you say, I hope you're as tolerant as you claim to be about XYZ, that he takes offense to, because he's like, if you're going to say this, man up and own it.
Right.
And that's what he says. He goes, if you're wanting to say something controversial, if you're wanting to say something out there, edgy,
expect there might be consequences.
And then accept said consequences. Yes. Don't say it and then go, oh, well, don't hold that against me. It's like, well, no, you either man up and own it or don't say it. And there are plenty of times you have to hold your tongue.
Definitely do a social media pen.
Yeah, that's for another
that's
time.
What I'm
yes, sir, in the back, right here.
What's your outlook on Hootsuite?
Hootsuite.
Oh.
It's becoming a social media panel. Do you guys
use
Hootsuite?
Yes, I've been trying. I recommended it for you to test out, because you can get your analytics nowadays.
Yeah.
You can do multiple platforms. Mm. My problem is that it's web based, so I have to be online with it. So I still tend to default to the main Facebook, Twitter, but I'm trying to teach myself how to use it more.
It's good for when you're going away somewhere. We go to conventions a lot, so if things are happening, we can line up stuff to,
sure.
to post mm-hmm. when we're away.
That's probably the best thing about Hootsuite is its scheduling capability, not just for
it in TweetDeck these days.
You can still do it in TweetDeck.
And TweetDeck just upgraded.
Mm. Yeah, but TweetDeck also downgraded by no longer supporting Facebook.
Right.
And the other thing, and here's where it gets complicated with Hootsuite. It's great to schedule stuff. However, your statistics are a little foobarred when it comes to Facebook posts from Hootsuite versus stuff that you schedule using Facebook entirely, which you can do. But my recommendation is try to find applications, try to find apps that will do stuff for you simultaneously in real time. A good example is Instagram. Instagram is a photo app, photo sharing app. But the nice thing is not only are you sharing stuff on Instagram, but you can also say share this on Flickr, share this on Facebook, and share this on Twitter. One post, you've hit four different networks. So that's nice to be able to do. Hootsuite's a great app. You just have to keep playing with it and understand what you're getting yourself into, and its limitations as well as its advantages.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? None at all? Well, then I think we will wrap up. And wow, we went a lot longer than we expected. thank you all very much.